Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. That, of course, a whole new world from the classic Disney Broadway musical called Aladdin. You've seen it in New York. If not, it's still playing. It came to Chicago. It's traveled the world. And joining me now is the composer, the songwriter who wrote the music, not just for that show, but for Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast and Newsies and A Bronx Tale and Little Shop of Horrors, which you'll hear from later. Enchanted. The truth is, if I keep going with the shows you've written, Alan, we'll actually never get to the interview. It's that long. Alan Menken joins me, and I'm thrilled to have you. Thank you, sir.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And we're talking because you are coming to the Auditorium Theater on Saturday, March 30th. It is Alan Menken in concert. I'm proud to be the sponsor of that show. And tell me about what that evening is going to be. I'm picturing it's you, a piano, and a lot of great history.
Yeah, me, a piano, three screens, which have kind of visuals and some videos. So basically I'm sharing the stories behind the songs, kind of, talking about my life, what led to my career, and then, highlights of my career and stories behind those moments, and, just an evening of sharing my work.
You're still a relatively young guy. I mean, the truth is, when you look at your body of work, and I lost count, I don't know, it's 11 Grammys, I think, and the 8 Academy Awards, Golden Globes, Tonys, it goes on and on. Is it me, or it seems as though you've had an amazing amount of success and production, and you're still a young guy?
Well, thank you. I mean, I guess I'm relatively young. I'm getting up there, but I'm feeling great, and I've had a very blessed career, and I pinch myself sometimes.
Well, I do too, and that's just because I'm listening. And you've had some great writing partners through the years. By the way, I'm forgetting the year of this. I think I'm going back to in the early 70s. But I remember falling in love with the music of The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz. Duddy Kravitz, right?
Yes, with lyrics by David Spencer.
Yeah, I mean, that it was just great. I think it was Richard Dreyfuss's, I'm pretty sure his first film.
That was one of his first films, yeah.
Just great work. Well, I want to talk a little bit about, first of all, the importance of collaboration, because somebody very important in your life was Howard Ashman, who we lost back in 1991.
Yeah,
you've worked with Tim Rice. You've worked with some of the greats. How important is that collaboration effort? And can you talk a little bit about the process? You're about to write a classic. Well, you don't know it's going to be a classic, but it's about to be in Beauty and the Beast or whatever. Talk to me about how that happens.
Well, collaboration is one of the great benefits of working in theater or film or any form where you're telling a story through song, but it involves more than just the songs. It involves the book. It involves choreography. It involves direction. It involves lights. It involves so many artists collaborating. And the joy of collaboration is that in every situation, you're kind of rolling the dice in a different way, and it really helps to invigorate what you're doing. It brings freshness to everything. And in order to be a good collaborator, you always want to be willing to listen to your collaborator, to never fall in love with your own work, to be always willing to throw something out and start over again. And because it's really about that group, the group dynamic, the group effort to create the best experience of telling this story, whatever it is, through songs and through music. And with each, I could take, if I had written Little Shop of Horrors, let's say, with Stephen Schwartz, it probably would have been a different show. If I had written, Beauty and the Beast with Glenn Slater, it would have been, and not say it would have been better or worse, but that's the joy of collaboration is that it just brings out freshness in everything you do.
If I had this right, when Howard Ashman passed in 91, you were in the middle of doing Aladdin. Is that right?
Yes. Well, when Howard passed away, he died 6 months before Beauty and the Beast was released.
Okay.
So he never really saw the completed movie. And we were, you know, I think he died thinking that we had fulfilled our assignment in writing Aladdin, but unbeknownst to him and to me, because they were protecting me from this, was a day we call Black Friday when there was a screening of Aladdin, and there were just major changes needed. And so after Howard passed, I was told about that, and then I teamed up with Tim Rice to complete the score with the changes that were being instituted. And Howard, we were midway through. There was a musical based on the life of Babe Ruth that we were partway through that we, you know, never completed.
Hmm.
There's a trunk of songs that, and of course there was a huge amount of material for Aladdin that was cut for the movie that I didn't know if it would ever see the light of day.
Was there so when Tim Rice comes in? Did things shift, or did Tim then attempt to sort of mirror Howard and say, "Look, we already have the flavor here, and I've got to play to that."
Yeah, I mean, Tim really wanted to sort of join the party the way Howard had said it, and but Tim has his own vocabulary and his own style, so it was sort of a combination of both. With a song like One Jump Ahead, that was very much in the style of the songs we had cut, like Babcock of Mara, Aladdin Kasim, which is in the Broadway show, or like Friend Like Me or Prince Ali. Whereas, you know, obviously A Whole New World really goes into its own vocabulary. It still, I think, really is seamless with the rest of the score, but it takes the score in a different kind of direction. I don't know if Howard and I would have written that song or a song like that. The ballad that we had written for Aladdin was called Proud of Your Boy. And it was very much in the Ashman Menken style.
Yeah, which is amazing. Can you talk about the difference? You've written for so many animated films in the Disney world, but then enter Chaz Palminteri and Robert De Niro with A Bronx Tale, which I absolutely love. I've already seen it 3 or 4 times, including New York, with Chaz in it, by the way. So having said that, how different is it writing for the live Broadway stage versus an animated film?
Well, it's different and the same depending on which aspect you're looking at. The mediums are different, so that structurally there's going to be a lot of differences. The basic DNA of how you're going to create a musical remains the same. You still look for a vocabulary that's going to inform the story, that's going to be unique and both unique within my career, but also hopefully unique in general for an audience coming in. And so that basic impulse of how you treat your central character and how you treat, you know, the storytelling is the same. But, you know, where a film, it's not a two-act medium. A film is usually considered to be like a three-act medium. You have an act break generally with a theater show. Not always, but often you do. So you structure towards that end, knowing that at the end of act one, you want to be in a certain place where you have the audience, you know, wondering what's going to happen in the second half. You have just basic tentpole moments that are essential to each medium. Of course, working on Bronx Tale was different in a whole other way, which is, although Chaz is a man who has a lot of experience in the theaters in terms of his one-man show, he really had never worked on a musical before at all. So between him and Bob, they were very new to it and suspicious of the form of musical theater. So it was a process of creating a marriage between people who worked in theater and people who did not and were kind of suspicious of that.
You also would reach out, and I think this was you that Chaz told. Chaz was on my podcast a week or two ago, and he told the story of during the song One of the Great Ones, which I have to tell you, and I think I hate you for this because I can't get some of the songs like that one out of my head. It's right? You know how to write those songs that we are stuck with, so I kind of love you for it, but I hate you for it. Anyway,
so it's okay.
Chaz talked about the fact that, and I thought it was your idea, that we see that image of his mother towards the end of that song as it kind of, you know, portrays the fact that there had been a potential relationship between Sonny and his mom. And he said that he didn't think it would work. I thought it was your idea. And he said, and of course, you were absolutely right. But did that come from you? Because that wouldn't have been a song thing, but a staging thing.
I'm not sure if it was me or Jerry Zaks or, you know, that, and again, this is the thing about collaboration. You're in the room and you're really not there for your ego. You're there just to, you know, let the best idea win. So I can't, people will often say, oh, that was your idea. I go, was it? Okay, I don't remember that.
But, well, he gave you credit. And yeah, we talked about your score. Yeah, you actually, for some reason, you seem to show up in many of my shows. I don't know why, whether you're here or not. Now, at least I got you live.
I like that.
And what about that transfer? So I talked about stage versus movie, but what about when an Aladdin goes from movie to stage? So now it's, in many ways, the same score. There's songs you have to hold on to. You can't get rid of them if you wanted to. Why does that impact the transition?
Well, again, okay, so when in this, you're dealing with a new director, so certainly I wanted to. If you bring in a director like Casey Nicolau, it was perfect for going back to the original conception that Howard and I had for Aladdin, which was, yes, it's a romance, but it's really a buddy picture also. And as we're going after initially was kind of an homage to the Hope Crosby Road picture genre, and also even the old Fleischer cartoons. So stylistically, it was very, very oriented towards a Hollywood kind of wink at the mysterious East with a really sincere heart to it. And again, you see, if you bring in a director like Casey Nicolau, you really know you're going to want to really have those production numbers that's going to blow the back of the theater off. Also, we have a Chad Beglin writing the book, and Chad is very, very skillful and funny and clever, and also writing some new songs. So you're opening it up, you're creating it for a new form, you're adapting to a new collaboration. And I had an agenda going in, which was very specific, which is we have these songs that Howard and I wrote for the movie that ended up getting cut when the sidekicks got cut and when Mom got axed, as often happens in Disney animation. A number of songs just fell off the table. And I wanted those songs back. And so that really defined a lot of the process of what we were going to do with it. And it was years of process of doing those things, and it was actually a very smooth, a very successful process. But even in a successful process, you're still going to have years of tinkering and playing and cutting and putting things back in and changing things. And
Did you always worry about, as I said, I do a backstage show on Broadway. When I did Aladdin, I thought Casey was in the show and Adam Jacobs and everybody. And it was interesting, after we taped the show, I didn't know it, but Disney Legal happened to be in the audience. I guess they do that a lot. And they came up with a few notes of what would not be in the show when it aired, in our show, things we said or things we talked about that they were concerned about. Do they bother you too?
Do they bother me, or do you mean do they
influence? Are they present in your
work? To be honest, I'm very used to it.
Okay.
And you know what? If you look at our world right now, and you look at how people can say something, and it just blows up in your face, and that's not something that Disney invented. It just happens now. I'm really kind of appreciative that they're very careful about those things. I think it's fine. Yeah. They're very careful about not offending sensibilities. They're very careful about how cultural stereotypes are dealt with. Very, very sensitive to that. And but that is a part of what we deal with absolutely on a daily basis. But also, I dealt with this on A Bronx Tale. There were many more four-letter words in our original version of A Bronx Tale. And Michael David, our producer, when we were previewing in New York, took us aside and said, okay, look, guys, group sales are coming now. You want to leave all those four-letter words in, I can't make you cut them, but you're going to have a run that's going to be a lot shorter because you're not going to get the groups.
Right.
And, you know, Chaz swallowed hard. I said, let's take a look at where we need it and if we really need it in those spots, how we want to treat it.
As you said, collaboration.
You know, it's not just Disney. It's really anyone who wants to have a decent run knows they have to be very careful about these kinds of issues.
Yeah. When you look back in the early days of your career, and some of the Dudley Kravitz and whatever, and you move forward, although I know Dudley Kravitz comes back as a, you know, like in 2015, I think, in Canada as a stage show.
Yeah, but we had a great production in Canada and in cast album.
Is it coming to the U.S.? I don't think I've seen it here.
No, it's not, I don't. Maybe it will. I haven't kept tabs on it. I've really been hoping that we would simply get to Stock and Amateur because I'd like it to be available for people to do.
Yeah,
I think it's a wonderful show. I know David is still trying to see if he can move us towards a production. God bless him for that.
I would love that. Yeah. But when you look at your early work and you see what you're doing now, and I know coming up, I think you've got Corona coming up. And do you see a growth in your work from the early days till now, or a progression, or do you say no? I'm kind of the same Alan Menken I was then. I'm just doing new stuff.
A little bit of both. It's certainly been a progression. For instance, I mean, before I met Howard Ashman, I was a composer lyricist. I was doing both, and I was developing a lot of shows. And that would have been, you know, certainly, I think I would have had a successful career, but it would have been a very different career. Starting with Howard, I really began to hone my abilities as a lyricist into being just a composer, but working with many different lyricists at different levels of experience. And that shaped a lot of what I do. And with each collaborator, certainly I change and I grow. I mean, besides that, since I don't want to repeat myself, I'm always looking for new challenges, and that will obviously make me grow as an artist. But some of it is also just, you know, what comes along. There was a period where, you know, Pocahontas and Hunchback came along, and God knows that was a radical change from, you know, from the projects that preceded it. They were much more adult and much more serious. And then following that was Hercules with a gospel score. That was a whole other place to go to. By the way, I'm not doing Carina. That was, I was doing it, and then schedules and basic artistic intentions didn't work out.
Okay.
So that's not what I'm doing.
Okay.
I am doing a lot of other projects, but it's very fluid. And I guess the short answer is, I think I am generally the same artist I've always been, but I'm working with new people all the time, and so there's a natural growth simply by, you know, by being yourself, but in a changing world.
Well, as a guy who's in the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and as I said, all the Academy Awards and Golden Globes and Tonys, am I right? I could not find. I don't think you've yet won an Emmy, right?
Howard and I won an honorary Emmy back. Oh my God, back in the early 90s.
So we get to say you're EGOT, right?
I'm an honorary EGOT, not an official EGOT. But, you know, I was hoping that Gallivant would have earned me an Emmy, but it didn't.
Well, I would have voted for you.
I'll live. It's okay.
Well, Alan Menken is appearing at the Auditorium Theater. I can talk to you forever. So many things I want to ask you, but maybe you'll address them on the stage of the Auditorium Theater on Saturday.
Sure thing.
March 30th, where I'm proud to be the sponsor of it. You can go to the Auditorium Theater's website, get tickets, and I'm going to give them a little secret. If they actually put in the name Paul, me, they'll actually get a discount for tickets on that night. The Auditorium was nice enough to do that for me and for you, since we were going to be talking together.
That's great.
I can't wait to see you on March 30th. I was so excited when I actually first heard you were coming. And I said, absolutely, I want to play a role. Thank you for your time in talking to my audience here. I sure appreciate
my
it.
My pleasure, Paul. Great to talk to you.
We're going
to
go out playing another one of your classics. At least it's one of my favorites. I do the show. I get to pick the favorites that I want. And it's called Seize the Day from Newsies. And then, by the way, you might just want to listen on, Alan, because I'm then talking to the cast of Little Shop of Horrors. We're going to play more of your music in that interview, which follows. The great Alan Menken. Here's a little bit from Newsies.
Now is the time to seize the day. They're gonna see there's hell to pay. Nothing can break us. No one can make us. Quit before we're done. One for all and all for one for
Well, that's just one of my favorite shows of all time. And every time it comes back, which isn't often to be put up, I just can't wait to get over and see it. It, of course, is Little Shop of Horrors, and it is being put up now by the mastery of theater, the theater that really knows how to pick the shows that can run forever in Chicago, and that is the Mercury Theater Chicago. I've seen the show. It is great. And given the fact that we have just chatted with Alan Menken, the great songwriter of so many Broadway shows, including this one. And so what a great way to put to work Mr. Menken's work by talking to the cast and the director of Little Shop of Horrors, currently over at Mercury Theater. Joining me now, Christopher Cale Jones, who plays the role of Seymour. That's the lead. What a great role, and what a great job you did, Chris. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on with you, Paul.
And playing Audrey, not Audrey 2, but Audrey, is Dana Tretta, who actually, I mean, listen, the only one actress has played that role, as far as I know, everywhere, and that, of course, is Ellen Green. So she becomes the comparison point, I think. And to me, Dana, we didn't need Ellen. We had you. That was as good as it gets, and congratulations on the great role of Audrey.
Oh, thank you so much. It's very sweet of you to say.
And always making it happen in his great work after just coming off of Avenue Q, which ran for 35 years over at the Mercury Theater Chicago, the director, Walter Stearns. Walter, you know how to pick good shows. What do you guys sit down and just go, what show is going to really reach the family and play forever? Is that part of the magic?
That is part of it, yeah. And 35 years, I should be so lucky.
Well, maybe I was exaggerating a little bit, but you get the point. You had such great success with it. So let me start. Let me come to you, Chris. First of all, I think a lot of people know what Little Shop of Horrors is about. I'm going to ask you to tell the audience the plot. But what's interesting is when you hear about the plot, you'd kind of say to yourself, I'm sorry, what? That's a show? People would go see that? And, of course, it's one of the best there is. So go ahead and tell us. What's that show all about?
Sure, no problem. I'll try to keep it brief. So it's basically a show about these three characters who work in a floral shop. You've got, it's Mr. Mushnick's floral shop, so you got Mr. Mushnick, and you've got his kind of lovable loser assistant and worker named Seymour Krelborn, who I play, and then you've got this lovely and adorable woman named Audrey, who also works in the shop, and then we later find out she's got a boyfriend who's a dentist who is not so nice to her, and they all are kind of trapped in these lives that they want to escape, and that escape comes through a kind of magical device that they bring in with this very odd plant that looks kind of like a Venus flytrap that Seymour finds at a market one day, and it appears out of nowhere as if from outer space, and there's even a bit in the show where there's just a kind of an outer space sound right before the plant appears, and everyone in the world becomes attracted to this plant and wants to take a look at it, and the shop starts to get very successful, and everyone starts to kind of grapple with that success, and then we find out the plant is actually fed by eating human blood, so there's a bit of a horror aspect to the show in its comic veininess, and it eventually starts eating people whole and taking over the world, and that leads us toward the end of the play right there.
You know, it's funny, Dana, but every time, like if somebody says, don't ruin a movie for me or something, I'll just look and go, right. Oh, really? Because everybody dies. You know, it's just my way of not ruining the movie. Of course, it's always usually a joke, except when you're talking about Little Shop, you kind of mean it, except it doesn't it doesn't bother us. So talk to me about, you know, again, we've heard from Alan Menken and his incredible work throughout a wonderful career, but to me, the magic of this show, and I think what's kept it going for so many years, the strength of the voices, the power of the music, the volume, the blending, and you're one of the key people in that. So talk about the importance and how much you obviously love the music.
Yeah, I mean, I've loved it since I was a kid, and to be able to have the chance to work on it is an extreme happiness for me. And it's just, I mean, like, the minute we started our first rehearsal and started going over the music, everyone's shoulders are just kind of shaking and toes are tapping, and it's infectious. It just kind of gets in you, and Mr. Menken has the ability to provide that for his audience, and it just kind of, it takes you over. I my palms get sweaty, and I have to hold in my breath every night before I enter the stage, because it's this this huge something that I'm about to try to conquer, and I want to do it justice because it is that good. So it's a delight to do every night, but I breathe a sigh of relief when my character finally does die, because I've gotten through another one.
You can go into that plant and die a happy woman, right? And it's okay. Exactly. You kind of come back at the end. Everything's okay, folks who are listening in. You'll be just fine. And
yes.
And Walter, you know, when you cast this, I mean, you know, listen, it's been off Broadway. It's been played around the country. The movie, of course, made it absolutely iconic with Rick Moranis and Ellen Green, who always came back to reprise that role. Did any of that influence you in terms of the casting and directing of this show? Or did you approach this fresh and just go, hey, you know, we're going to do what we're going to do?
This is, as Dana alluded to, this is just a masterwork of musical theater. And, you know, we're stepping into some mighty big shoes. Steve Martin, everyone from Steve Martin, even Jack Nicholson did the original motion picture. And
that's right.
All of these great talents, Ellen Green, you referred to, Vincent Gardenia, they all left their mark, their fingerprints on these roles, and we'll always remember them in these roles. It's been a great pleasure sort of discovering the show for ourselves and for our own audience, and working with, you know, our local Chicago talent, Dana and Chris and a host of other talents, and bringing fresh life to these characters that we know and love so much.
Actually, Walter, I'm going to stay with you for this one because you were kind enough to take me backstage after the show to see the plants. There are various versions of Audrey too. It also takes more than one person, not necessarily to operate the puppet, but to make the voice happen. Can you talk about how that all gets coordinated?
Sure. Well, it's, you know, it's a show about a man-eating plant. So we put a lot of resources into how are we going to represent this man-eating plant on stage? And it's been done historically by a series of growing puppets that represent the plant. And, you know, we're at Mercury Theater. We just came off of the successful run of Avenue Q, which is another great puppet musical. And we just sort of dove in and said, well, this plant in our production is going to be this remarkable puppet. So we have two actors who share the role. One is inside of the puppet, and the other one is providing an extra special sort of vocal performance of the puppet of Audrey to the man-eating plant. And these two gentlemen work in synchronization, kind of in harmony. Even before they go out on stage, the two of them are behind the scenes warming up. One is singing and the other is puppeteering just to get ready for every performance.
I love it. Chris, in playing this role, look, you've done, you know, when people see you in this role, that, well, here's the guy that's always playing the nerdy, whatever, and you're not. I mean, you did. And I know you played this role in Washington at Forge Theater, which, by the way, how cool was it performing in Forge Theater knowing that, you know, the box where Lincoln was shot, it's actually still there. It's still marked off. Does that freak you out?
It's very cool. You definitely have a firm sense of history when you're performing there because, you know, you walk every day to your place of work and you know that that's where that happened and that the house across the way is still preserved where they took him immediately afterwards. So it's definitely a strong sense of history there.
And you hope and pray nobody jumps on the stage and yells anything, right?
Yes.
That's just a word of history there. But also one other connection with you. I think I've interviewed you before. When you did Jersey Boys, you were with the tour, were you not, with Michael Cuneo and Ingersoll and Sean Wiley?
I sure was. Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I was.
You actually did my Broadway backstage show way back when, and I was thinking about that, and so this brings us back together. Well, anyway, so talk to me about so and the reason I like to mention that is when you think of these roles you've done. I mean, you've been in Miss Saigon where you played Chris. You've done some pretty manly, tough guy kind of musical roles among other things, and then you do play Seymour. How is this a challenge? Is this fun? Is it weird? What is it like for you?
Absolutely. It's an absolute blast. I have been so fortunate in my career to play a vast kind of range of roles. I did Chris in Miss Saigon and Frankie Valli and Jersey Boys and a bunch of other things. And but Seymour's always been near and dear to my heart. I mean, I was a nerdy kid growing up, and I think that's part of what drove me toward acting is I wanted to live in other people's skin and try that on and see how it was, you know, like, oh, maybe I could be a doctor or I can be, a war veteran today, or I could do this. And that was a great deal of the appeal when I was a kid, also because I was kind of this creative, nerdy kid. I was smart. I always carried all my books everywhere. I was a nerd. And, so there's a lot of Seymour in me, you know, there's a lot, you know, in him. I think, you know, at the core of his character is that he just doesn't know to even think that he deserves more than the current life that he has. And there's a lot that I can definitely kind of relate to in that, in some of the ways that I grew up. I think that I was fortunate to have a loving family that taught me that I actually could kind of go after my dreams and attain things. And I've been fortunate to live a life that has had a lot of dream fulfillment. But I can definitely relate to kind of that introverted, insular sort of thing. And it's such a fun thing to do, to get to play a much more character-y sort of character, where you can have a lot of sense of humor with it. Again, like Walter said, this is a masterfully written musical theater piece, because one moment you are laughing hysterically at the antics of these lovable loser characters, and then the next moment you're crying because of how heartbreaking some of their struggles are.
Exactly. And you've worked with such great people. Dana, in the role, now, okay, I might be a little weird on this, because the last role that I saw you in, and you were amazing, was you played Gilda Radner in Bunny Bunny, which was incredible.
Thank you.
I kind of see this connection, this overlap between Audrey and a Gilda. I don't know if it's a naivete. What am I off base here? Or because when you take on a new role, I'm assuming you think about and call upon other roles that you've played, and you played many in this town. Is there any connection between those two in your mind, or is it me?
I don't think it's just you, and I don't think it hit me until maybe a few weeks ago, it's vastly different shows, but both women are kind of sad clowns in a way, I think. And what's terrific about both shows was you were able to see them at their best when they're optimistic and happy and things are moving forward positively for them. But then you strip all that away and you see what's truly underneath. And I think both women, I mean, Gilda, of course, her story is true. But Audrey as well, they've got some demons that they're struggling with. And I can relate the way I approach a role is usually inside out. That's, I don't know if every director likes that or not, but that's kind of how I attack it. And, yeah. The sensitive nature of me, Dana, really tries to link into what's going on with this character and what makes them tick and what makes them real, not just this over exuberant whatever, but what else is going on and what are they struggling with?
Well, I'm just glad it struck you, because I did think about that. Yeah. Walter, the musical director, Eugene Dyson, absolutely amazing. He had to have played a critical role. Well, I'll ask. Did he play a critical role in the casting? Because the voices in this show, they have to be powerful. They have to be full. They have to fill that space. They do. So are you going to take all the credit? Or you want to give Eugene some?
Oh, I wish I could take all the credit, but no. You know, it's a great collaboration. That's one of the great things about doing a musical is somebody used to say it's the intersection of all the arts. This one musical event is music and drama and dance and design and literature all in one spectacular sort of celebration. And of course, Eugene was on our, I'd be chagrined to say our award-winning musical director, has been doing a lot of these shows and worked very hard on finding the right voices and then styling them to really sound like a 1950s rock and roll show, which is what this is. Has this great 1950s musical sound to it that I think people just sort of leaves your toes tapping and people leave the theater humming this great musical score.
You know, Chris, I've always thought that doing a show with Walter and Eugene at Mercury has got to be a little different than other places. I wouldn't know because he refuses to cast me in anything, but. But I mean, you worked with them in the Bobby Darin show, and I guess, and because you've done national tours, so you've been at every level. I'm sort of curious. I feel like when you're performing at Mercury Theater, that even on stage, you might feel just the way audience members do. People who've been coming to see Walter's show for years, and that is, it's kind of like coming home. And it's a very personal, friendly nature about how these shows get put together. Or is Walter really a jerk, and I've just been misjudging him all these years?
The only thing jerky about Walter is that he hasn't cast you yet, and I'm so sorry. That's your reality.
No, I'm waiting for Fiddler. I'm waiting for Fiddler. He knows that.
Okay, perfect. No, Walter and Eugene are incredible, and they have this wonderful knack for not only picking entertainment that is something that people want to see, but picking performers that maybe not everyone has seen around town. You know, Dana's done so much great work around the city, but there were actually a couple of people we talked to, someone at an interview last week who was like, this is kind of like a great showing for you, Dana, that the city's going to get to see you do this. And she's been working for years, but when you do something at the Mercury, people take notice, and Walter and Eugene, you know, will pick people and put them in their shows that then will go on to do a lot more work because it's such a great showing for them. So they have a knack with their casting, with the kind of shows they do. And yes, it feels very much like a family atmosphere. They also have a knack for just casting good, genuine people. And so there's no one who brings any backstage drama to the show. We keep all the drama on stage. Everyone gets along like a great family. And it's the sort of thing where you kind of want the show to run forever because it's just such a wonderful experience.
Yeah, Dana, it looks like, this truly is an ensemble piece. Clearly, there are leads in this show. You, Chris, there are leads in this show. Tommy is Mr. Mushnick. David is Oren. And everybody else in the show is the bio, I think, says for him. But it looks like everybody really has to get along, and you need to, right? You need the three ladies who are in that kind of Supremes role that role. Everybody seems to blend together really well on that stage.
I think we do, and that's definitely with the help of Eugene and Walter, not only in the actual casting, but the environment they created. But, I mean, after our first rehearsal, I texted a friend of mine who's an actress as well, and I was like, those three girls are going to take the show away, and I'm so excited. Because, I mean, the nature of their role is to be the narrators of the show, but the energy and exuberance they have really starts everything off beautifully. And I love the times when my character gets to actually interact with them because they are such a huge voice of reason. Everybody on the stage is doing a great job because we want to and we're enjoying doing it. And that's a huge part of Chicago theater, this ensemble feeling. When you are lucky enough to be in a show where it doesn't matter about leads, and yes, the story is about certain people, but if everyone together can, you know, seemingly be holding hands while going through the show each night, happy and doing their jobs to the best of their ability, there's nothing greater. It's the best feeling in the world.
I agree. Little Shop of Horrors at Mercury Theater, Chicago. Before we go, I want people to enjoy a little bit more of that Alan Menken, Howard Ashman music, because we talked about Howard as well in the interview with Alan. Walter, there's fortunately no announced closing date. I think people need to get tickets at Mercury Theater, Chicago sooner than later, because you never know. But I am right. You have not set a closing date, so people will have some time to enjoy it.
Well, we've got a few more weeks left, and that's all the tickets that we put on sale through April 28th. And then we're hoping that the show can last for a couple of weeks thereafter. It's a supply and demand business. So as long as people are buying tickets, we'll do the show.
Perfect. And the truth is, when you see the show, you'll love it so much as I did. You're probably going to want to come back, so see it sooner than later. To give yourself a chance to get there that second time and bring some friends. The show was Little Shop of Horrors, music by Alan Menken, book and lyrics, Howard Ashman, and Christopher Cale Jones and Dana Tredda and Walter Stearns. Thank you, as always. If you don't mind, we're going to go out with a little of Alan's music and the song that you, Chris, and Dana sing to each other, though this is not your version, but you'll recognize it. This is Suddenly Seymour.
Self-conscious, there's a voice in the back of my head says, How's your breath?
You know, right? I get crazy, you know. Because there's nothing worse than walking up to a lady saying, hi. She says, no. You know, and then right away you want to do something. You try to check yourselves out. You can tell when guys are worried. You ever see a guy, hi, Fred, how you doing?
Well, that, of course, is some classic comedy, as we all remember him from the wonderful comedian Richard Pryor from years ago. Of course, he is gone now, but I'll tell you who is around and writing about his life is the son of Richard Pryor, and that is Richard Pryor Jr. His new book is called In a Pryor Life, spelled, of course, P-R-Y-O-R. But the truth is, Richard Pryor Jr. has had an incredible life on his own career, making it himself in the world of entertainment and such. And so I thought it'd be a great idea to chat. And Richard Pryor Jr., welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate you. So here's the thing. I'm going to guess, let's just be upfront about it. Every time you meet somebody and you say that you're Richard Pryor Jr., the conversation immediately goes to your dad, and even I open with a clip. But do you like to have that conversation, or do you prefer to say, let's talk about what my life and career have been about?
Well, I would prefer, you know, as far as people to know me, who I am, versus who my father was. But it's very, being the son of someone like that, it's very difficult to get past that. So a lot of times in life, you have to learn to deal with things, and you know that expectations, you know what's going to happen. So you have to just deal with it, grin and bear it, and go through it, and then allow them to know who you are as the person.
And I think it's important that we get to know you, because the truth, and I've read your book, and great facts, great stories in it. First of all, let's just, you know, this is a Chicago-based talk show we're on right now, so let's put that right out there. You were born here. You were raised Peoria, but you were raised in the Chicago area.
Yeah, Peoria, Illinois, not too far from Chicago. Yeah, so the Midwestern values, and well, the values... According to my family, you know, that's what it was. But raised and born in high school and everything in the Peoria area.
And the other thing is, I think the reason that it's important to talk about you separate from your dad is because, at least as I understand your story, your dad vanished around the age when you were at the age of two. So it's not as though he raised you on a daily basis and was around the house. He was doing his thing.
Right. He left when I was very young to go pursue his career. He told my mother he would be gone 3 months, and he was gone exactly 3 years. And it was actually, when he came back, he was actually shocked that I was walking. She said, what do you expect? You've been gone 3 years. So, yeah, it's an amazing story, but he had to do what he wanted to do to make it so, you know, to do what he wanted to do and love what he loved to do. And he had to make it, and that's the sacrifice he had to make.
And your mom, Patricia Price, who had several, you know, relationships after your dad and such. But I thought it was interesting, Richard, that you dedicated the book to your mom, not to your dad. And so obviously that talks about the importance of your relationship with your mom. But is there any more to that than that, as opposed to dedicating it to your parents who, you know, gave you your name?
Well, my thing, what it was that I wanted people to know there was more to my life than just Richard Pryor, that my mother was just as important, if not more so, than my father. So I wanted to really stress that so people knew it wasn't just about my dad. It was about my mom. Because so many times that people speak of my father but never mention my mother, who was an important part of my life. She gave me the substance and the spirit and the personality, everything that I am, came from her. So I had no choice in my heart but to dedicate it to her and speak highly of her in that area.
And in fact, I think what capsulizes maybe your mom's experience in life and her relationships, and I don't know if this was a bit tongue-in-cheek or maybe it was just true when you wrote it in the book, but you talked about the fact your mom wanted to be a mortician because dead people don't hurt you. Was that tongue-in-cheek? Was that real?
Oh, no, that was real. When they were younger, they talked about, you know, their dreams, and his was to be a comic. She wanted to be a mortician. And she had always told me the reason why, because I would ask her about, why would you want to be a mortician? She would tell me, you know, dead people are the ones that won't hurt you. It's the people that are alive that you have to be worried about. So, you know, it got to an opportunity. I remember when my dad became famous, he offered to send her to mortician school. And she was like, hell, by the time I finish, it'll be time for me for the casket. So, you know, she didn't pursue it, but, you know, it was a dream of hers.
You were also raised with grandparents and whatever, I know, and your grandmother, even that was interesting, Richard. I mean, your grandmother owned, it's a brothel, right? I don't know what else to call it except that, but you were, and you would go and kind of hang with the prostitutes.
Yeah, I would go to my great grandmother's and everything, and you know, I would sit around and play cards, and they would teach me how to play spades, and we'd play cards, and they'd say, you know, hold the hand, I got to go upstairs and handle the business, and you know, come back down, and we'd finish the card game. So it was a very normal thing to me.
Thank you for wording it that way, because in the book you were a little more graphic about what they said to you about why they had to step away for a few moments.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So then you yourself have created kind of, I mean, you had your days in the Navy, in the service, you know, your days in the entertainment. And you get the sense from reading about your background that that was always in you, but I imagine it's hard to divorce the fact that you see your dad living this celebrity life, and that has to rub off, at least the positive parts of it had to rub off and create a dream in you.
Yeah, I think that it really did help as far as me wanting to pursue in the entertainment industry. But also, before I really knew how strong my father was in that industry, I was always into like performing and different things like that at a young age. So I think it was just in my DNA. And it's just that, you know, being able to see him and what he did was easier for me to reach for that and come out into that atmosphere.
Was your mom very positive about your dad? I mean, after he sort of took off, how much did he stay in your life, her life? I mean, I know she went on to other relationships. A man named, I think, Harry Price it was, who was fine.
Yeah, unless
he was drinking, that was a problem. But, I mean, did she sort of regret those days, or was Richard Pryor just a chapter of her life and yours?
He was a chapter of her life, but they stayed in contact. They stayed friends. You know, he would always do for her if there's anything that she needed or anything like that. So they always stayed connected, you know, throughout their lives, because one thing I appreciate about their marriage is their marriage was not based on his career and his stardom. It was based on the fact that, you know, she cared about him, and because when they were married, he had nothing and wasn't anything. You know, my mother said at times, you know, he barely had a toothbrush and toothpaste. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So,
yeah.
And by the way, I have to ask you this, and you, given how you answered a previous question, I made the comment about the language. Do you know why I used a clip of your dad? That was from the Ed Sullivan Show back in 1966, something like that. Do you know why I used that clip?
Well, it was probably the only cleanest thing you could probably air.
That is exactly right. I went through more clips of him, and that even included on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Even there, he's bleeped and bleeped all the way through. Course, his stand-up, everything else, his albums, everything I was going through to try and just open with a little bit of your dad, you could not find a routine without dirty words in there. And the reality, today, of course, that's every comedian. But back in the 60s, that wasn't the case, was it?
No, he was considered like a trailblazer in that aspect. I mean, you had other comics like Lenny Bruce and Red Fox and those type of people that, you know, used dirty language, but there was no one as mainstream as him when he came out and just speaking it like it was. And that was his life. The language and everything like that was the way he was raised, the way we were raised on my dad's side of the family. That's the way people talk. So it wasn't a thing of like him using it as fillers. It was actually literally the words that he knew because of his upbringing.
You had an interesting chapter when you turned 13, and your dad was in Chicago, I imagine, performing, and he came to Peoria to see you. It was your birthday, and he gave you a couple of gifts. It was a chemistry set and a jogging suit. And there was kind of a confrontation between him and your stepdad, Harry. Your dad still wanted that recognition that he indeed was your dad.
Oh, yeah. He literally pretty much fought for that, you know, letting my stepdad know, regardless, you know, you are raising him and, you know, he's in the household, but that is my son. And he wanted to stress that I was his son. And I thought it was an important thing, besides the jogging suit, of course, that was another story. But, yeah, you know, he wanted to show his love and prove his love.
And talk about you started in school, you start writing scripts, so this performance thing is in you, but not in the way it was for your dad. You were not about to be a comedian. You were not. That was not the road you were taking. You kind of put yourself more almost in a musical world, a stage world. Talk about how that interest developed for you in those early days.
Yeah. Well, I think what it was, it started like, you know, I was writing scripts and everything for my family and cousins when we would put on productions when I was younger. But when I got to high school, it was always a thing of performing in front of people, not in stand-up, but in stage plays and things of that nature. So I gravitated towards that. It was an outlet for me.
but it was a way for me to be my own self, and it wasn't like I was following in my father's footsteps. I wasn't doing stand-up. I was following my own path as far as a performer. I was, you know, I was funny, but it was scripted funny. It was things that were written for me and how I could take those things and make a line funny that wasn't supposed to be, how I could do those things. And I had the opportunity to do that on stage. And, you know, I couldn't do that in comedy because I was compared to my father so much, you know, that it was not a win-win situation at all for me in that aspect.
And you started to develop, you also, and by the way, part of your life was you were doing drag, that kind of thing. And there was a period of time, and I wouldn't ordinarily bring this up, but you write about it, so that makes it fair game. And that was when your dad got wind of the fact that, well, you might be gay, and he challenged you on that, and you denied it. It's sort of that bridge into your entering the Navy. But I have to admit that the story about how he told you he was hearing that was really interesting. You tell that story, but don't use the words he used.
Well, I mean, his thing was, he was asking me because, you know, there were people that were caught in the guest house where I was living.
Right.
And they were showing the house, which I wasn't aware of, to put it on the market. And I remember coming back home, and I left, and the people that were still there at the house, they were cleaning. I'm like, why are you guys cleaning? I was like, you didn't see her? And she comes to the door, you know, Richard Jr., your father wants to speak to you on the phone. And he flat out, you know, asked me. You know, he was calm about it, but asked me, and of course I denied it because I wanted to continue his love. I didn't want to be hated, and I thought I would be hated if I told the truth. So I just started bawling, you know, putting on the acting tears and all that stuff, and, you know, he let it go, but he let me know that he didn't believe me, that, yeah. I knew sooner or later that the truth would have to come out in my life.
And that was also, that was like around 1980. So, I mean, that's not exactly the dark ages, but, you know, and your dad living in the world of entertainment, you would think would be a bit more hip, right, on those kinds of issues? Or is it one of those situations where it's like, I don't care, but not my kid?
Well, I think it was a thing, but when you're young and you're going through things in your life like that, you think you're the only person that has ever gone through that. And you're the only person that's, you know, feeling the way you're feeling, and the only one that is scared of rejection, and, you know, thinking that your parents would hate you and your friends and family would hate you and never speak to you again. So you have to live with that. And, you know, coming out with something like that was a very terrifying thing because of rejection that you thought you might get.
So you tried to hide the answer by going into the Navy, although I recall in that chapter you sort of in a funny way say, and cue the village people. So,
oh, yeah, it was totally, yeah.
What were the Navy days like?
The Navy days, the traveling was good, but it was crazy wild. I mean, the things that I was running from were all there, and it was like laid out on a platter for me, so it was hard to reject the things that I was running from because they were there and they were readily available and it was acceptable.
After those days, you again continue in the performing world, and you danced in a club called, or performed, I should say, in a club in Peoria called Club Peoria. So you kind of came back home with all of this, and you developed a stage name of Rainey McKnight. That was a drag name for you. But what I found interesting about that was part of it, other than it's a great name, but part of that was your thought was if a family member had to roam in that club, they were not going to recognize you. And I've seen pictures of you.
Yeah.
You look great.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, it was funny about the thing, I was constantly hiding it, and I remember years later, you know, after I told my mother about it, I remember her actually saying, you know, the fact that, oh, now I know why that dress was missing. I was wondering why my clothes were coming up missing and jewelry and things of that nature. But she actually had an opportunity, her and my aunt, Angie, actually had an opportunity to come to one of my shows, so it was a relief off my back. It was a lot of weight off my shoulders as far as them actually seeing me perform.
Obviously, your dad had battles with drugs and alcohol and those kinds of things, but you did too, and you had some visits in rehab as well that needed to pull you back.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the thing about it, going through those things, you would think that, you know, near-death experiences and all those things that I went through, that it would be enough for me, but it wasn't. You know, it wasn't until I was much older after I lost my parents that I realized, you know, my self-worth. You know, and when you're going through those things, you don't think that you're going to fall into those traps like everybody else. You think that you're just doing things on a recreational basis, and not realizing the effect and the hold it's having on your life because of the things that you went through in your life, play an effect to those things.
What was your relationship like with your dad at the time that he died? Because there are those who kind of blame you for it and blame you for why things happen. I know that's not the case.
Yeah, yeah. It was, you know, the thing about it, I love my dad dearly, but unfortunately his wife saw fit in her arena to separate me from my dad because I wasn't agreeing with her and wasn't falling in line with the things that she thought I should fall in line with. Once you would disagree with her, she pretty much cut you out, and she did that with me. She cut me out of my dad's life for 6 years. I wasn't able to see him, so it was a very difficult time and a hard time for me. But when I did get to see him, it was a joyous thing, but also sad because I tell my mother it passed 2 years prior to that. But then when I saw him and left him and kissed him goodbye, I knew it would be the last time I saw him, and that was in 2005. Yeah.
And how did he relate to you, given all that you had been through? Was it a healing moment, cathartic for both of you?
Yeah, it was a healing moment, and it was a moment you could tell that he had missed me. And it was that's what the thing was so wonderful about it, you know, being able to embrace him and, you know, just to hug him and let him know how much I loved him in spite of everything that he had heard and everything that he had thought because of what was put into his ear.
You write so much in the book about your family, different family members. We get to know them pretty well. I mean, your mom, your grandparents, obviously very, very close for you. Talk to me about where you are now, Richard, what you're doing. Can people, you were in Color Purple, you did extras work, so many things in your background. What is Richard Pryor Jr. doing today?
Well, other than my regular, you know, doing my auditions, hitting the concrete jungle here in New York City, I'm actually working on now to adapt my book into a one-man show. Because I'm known for cabaret and things like that out here, but I actually want to do an actual one-man show based on my book, portraying all the characters in the book. So that's one thing I'm working on now, and actually doing my mini book tour coming back to Peoria, Illinois on April 10th. So I'm excited about that as well.
And I know your current partner is Tom. You're happy. Your personal side, all of that in life is good as well?
Well, yeah, everything's good. I'm no longer with Tom. I mean, Tom and I haven't been together in over a year.
Oh, sorry about that.
So, yeah, but we are still really, really good friends. We speak daily and all those things. It's just that my life took a different direction as far as what I wanted out of life. And because of my journey and because of realizing and opening my eyes up as far as the things I wanted out of life. But it doesn't mean that I don't care about him. But it's just that at this point in my life, I'm in a different direction, in a different realm right now.
And you decided to put it all down in this book, in a prior life. I mean, I think people in your situation, the reason they write these kinds of books is, again, the need for catharsis, the need to work through some things and put it out there. So now that this is out there and people like me have read all about your life, I didn't know about your life till I read the book, but now it's on the table. How do you feel?
Yeah, I feel great about it. It wasn't just a thing for me to write it for myself, but it was to write it for other people who may be going through things, because a lot of times when you're going through something in life, you think you're the only one and no one understands. No one understands the pain that you're in at the time. But I wanted people to see hope and see, you know, you have a chance to come out of that dark tunnel that you're in and that you can survive and you can be happy once again.
In fact, that's what you sort of closed the book, and you've got a comment on the back that said, you know, in fact, you did survive, and that's what the book is about. A real life story of overcoming obstacles, surviving, and thriving. The truth is, Richard, so many of us, people go through that throughout their whole lives. So your life, in many ways, maybe you had a little celebrity component in your life a lot of people don't have, but the struggles were the same as most people have.
Right, exactly. And that's what I wanted to show people, that I'm no different than you are. You know, I'm the same as you are. You know, nothing's better because of who I am. I still struggle and went through things in my life.
Well, the book is called In a Pryor Life by Richard Pryor Jr. with the help of Ron Brower. People can get it at Bear, as in the animal bear, bearmannermedia.com. And I imagine Amazon. I didn't look on there, but I suppose it's on Amazon as well.
Yes.
All right.
Yes, definitely.
Check it out. If you're a fan, whether you're a fan of Richard Pryor or not, doesn't really matter, because you probably become a fan of Richard Pryor Jr. when you read the book and read about his struggles, his life, and the influence that family had in his growing up. Richard, thank you so much for your time. I sure appreciate it. And I wish you success in the book, and I look forward to the new chapter when that takes place.
Thank you so much for having me.
You got it. Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnick.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.